Medical Matters on Talk About, brought to you in association with the Bon Secours Hospital Tralee, celebrating 200 years of the Bon Secours mission.
And a warm welcome to Eamon. How are you?
How are you doing? Very good indeed.
Good stuff.
Just to take up on your last point there, there's another interesting one that has a medical dimension to it, because if you think about it, anything that's child-proof is often adult-proof as well. And particularly for older adults, the child-proof containers can be quite difficult. Now, I know our pharmacist colleagues will be saying that there are things like, for example, blister packs and things like that. But I certainly know that some of the medications can be really, really difficult to get into because they're so securely tied up, and sometimes you have to use a scissors to cut through them and so on and so forth. So that's just another consideration.
Yeah, and I find, I mean, I'm fit and able-bodied. I find opening jars.
I think the point you made about the aids and appliances, the things that you can get, but there again, you're going to have to buy these things. But there are devices you can get which will help to open up, and you shouldn't have to be sticking them in the jamb of the door to try to open up the bottles, but get these devices that increase your leverage to open them up. But some of them are really, really tightly sealed, and it can be really, really hard to open them.
Do you know, and on a lighter note, do you know what I'm talking about with those mayonnaise and ketchup sachets?
I know the sachets you see in the camera. Yeah.
They're impossible to open.
Oh yeah, they are. And you get them on the plane as well too. There's a tiny little notch in the top, and if you're lucky, if you can just tear the little notch, you're away for slates, but it's actually tearing that's the problem.
Yeah, Pat agrees with me. Pat on sound today says he finds them hard to open as well.
That sputtering everywhere all over you.
Sputtering ketchup all over your face. Anyway, we'll move on, Eamon, and just to remind listeners, general queries today, and I'll try and come to them in the order in which they came in, and this one came in first. I'm a 50-year-old woman. She's very active, but she had a knee
arthroscopy
5 weeks ago. It improved for a while, but the pain has now returned in her meniscus, and she's wondering, will it ever improve?
Yeah, a specialist area, but also a tricky and troublesome area. The difficulty is that of all the joints of the body, the knee joint is probably one of the most complex, because while it's strictly speaking a hinge joint, there's a bit of rotation there, and we also have various things of bits of cartilage and the tendons and so on. And the difficulty is that if there's chronic sprain or strain in these, this can lead to discomfort. I suppose there's two ways of looking at this. One of them, well, there's probably three ways. One is the actual physics of the actual structures in the joints. Are the cartilages intact? Are the tendons intact? Are the bones intact? And if any of those are not working, that in itself can be a cause of pain. The second issue is, could it be to do with the surrounding structures? And I'm sure that the physios will probably be telling us straight away that there are things that people can do from a physical therapy and physio point of view that would help to strengthen the muscles around the joint, which help to make the joint more stable. And the third element is that people can suffer from and do suffer from what's called nerve pain. So you can get discomfort in the knee, even where there's no obvious mechanical problems. In large measure, it's going to be going back to the specialist and possibly also talking to a physio as well to try and find a solution to our problems.
Okay. Now, query for Dr. Eamon, says this listener. This is a 27-year-old male. He says, my nose is blocked. I can kind of breathe in and out through it, but not much. I can't blow it out.
Yeah.
I went to a walk-in clinic and they gave me steroids, antibiotics and a nasal spray. And it didn't work. I have it for 3 or 4 weeks now. Anything else I can do?
Yeah. So there's rather blunderbuss treatment there, taking all the antibiotics, steroids and the nasal sprays. I think what you have to understand is what is the underlying cause of the problem. And the questions I'd be asking is this something that's only just happened this year, or is this something that happens most years, particularly at this time of the year? And the reason I'm saying out of that is that rhinitis or hay fever is hugely common. And one of the problems is that people can develop these conditions called nasal polyps. You can get these little benign growths in the nose that will physically block the nose up and make it very difficult to breathe through the nose. Somebody needs to look up your nose for you. That's the issue. Somebody actually literally needs to look up your nose with the appropriate equipment and see what's going on inside there, so that you can again then get direction. The problem with polyps is that you can remove them and they are removed, but they'll grow back nearly as quickly as they're removed. So then you need to look at the cause, and the underlying cause, is it inflammation? Is it allergy? Is it infection? And then appropriately treat that.
Now, this listener says, Deirdre, hope you're well. I am, thank you. I'm a male in midlife who has osteoporosis due to a number of medications for another condition. Yeah. I was put on Fosfans for it, which helped, as well as Calcichew, and other ways you can help yourself with the condition. Over the years since then, I have osteopenia now.
Yeah. It's come back. Yeah, go on, yeah. It's making sense, don't worry.
Will I be on Frostvance for the rest of my life?
Yeah.
Is my doctor afraid if I'm taken off it that I'd be back to square one again?
Okay, really interesting points there. So firstly, while we associate osteoporosis typically with older women, it can affect any age group, though it tends to become more common as you get older. One of the difficulties is that particularly long-term steroid use can be particularly hard on the bones. It increases bone turnover, increased bone loss, and it can lead to osteoporosis. Now, again, it's a radiological definition. When you get the specific investigation for osteoporosis, which is a thing called a DEXA scan, and it works on a negative score from a 0 down to negative 1 down to minus 1 is considered normal bone density. From minus 1 down to minus 2.5 is a state called osteopenia, which is a condition where there is reduced bone density but not so severe as to cause clinical problems, and then minus 2.5 and less is where you've got osteoporosis. The treatment that our listener has been taking and the particular medication he's talking about, the generic name for it is alendronic acid or alendronate, and that has to a degree reversed it, though I would strongly suspect it's actually the interventions. So weight bearing exercise, which means walking, making sure of an adequate intake of calcium, vitamin D are also needed. And the thing is, you've reversed your bone loss from the osteoporosis phase up into the osteopenia stage. Now, the issue is that there are none of the currently available treatments for osteoporosis that you can actually take for life. But it's not a case of your GP being afraid to take you off it. Sooner or later, they will have to take it off you anyway, because the difficulty is that the long-term use of these medications is associated with issues and problems. With regards to the Fosfavans, with regards to the alendronic acid, very quickly, it is what they call very tightly bound to bone. The actual molecule actually is bound, so is that after you stop taking the alendronic acid, it will continue to work for a number of years afterwards. You will continue to be monitored, and there are alternatives. But there again, the alternatives are you take it for a while and then you go off it for a while and you go back. So the likelihood is that one way or the other, you will be taking some form of treatment, maybe not all the time, but probably for the rest of your life.
Oh my goodness. And of course, the problem if you do have osteoporosis is that if you break a bone, you're in big trouble.
Yeah, the big difficulty of osteoporosis is that people don't know they have osteoporosis until something actually happens. And typically, either you get a spontaneous fracture of a hip, or you get a spontaneous fracture of one of the bones in the back, one of the vertebrae in your back, or you fall and you break a wrist or something like that. So it's generally only when there has been some major problem, and particularly with the osteoporotic, the collapse of the bones due to osteoporosis in the back, that's a really painful condition. It takes a long, long time to heal up.
And when you say weight-bearing exercises, you said walking, but does doing weights help as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Weight training would help as well too. I'd be getting the advice of the appropriate professionals, either physiotherapists or physical therapists, or going to the local gym and talking to somebody there. I would not want to advise people about what to do, but weight-bearing of any and all forms would be beneficial.
Okay, very good. Texter says, will you please ask Dr. Amon, how would you know if you were a celiac?
Very simple and straightforward. There is a screening blood test your GP can do. So being a celiac myself, I'm well aware of this. The thing you do is a thing called an endomysial antibody blood test. Now, the thing is that the endomysial antibodies are antibodies. They're things that are produced by your body in reaction to the gliadin, which is the stuff in gluten that causes the problem. You have to be taking gluten before you do the blood test. If you put yourself on a gluten-free diet and go and do the blood test will almost certainly be negative, and then you don't know where you're standing. So the strong advice is continue your normal diet, include if you can things that contain gluten in your diet, get the blood test done. If the blood test shows that you've got raised levels of these endomysial antibodies, then beyond that, the confirmation is by having what's called a gastroscopy, where you get a surgeon or a physician who will put a camera down into your tummy, and they look at the first part of the bowel after the stomach, an area called the duodenum, which is the area that's particularly affected by celiac disease, and they'll look to see if the little velvety lining on the lining of that part of the bowel is stripped off, and they'll take a biopsy from that. Absolutely nails the diagnosis, and then once you have that diagnosis, you know where to send, and then you go off on your gluten-free diet for the rest of your life.
And how do you find it, the gluten-free diet?
As you're aware, I was away travelling recently. Most parts of the world, it's okay, and it's absolutely no problem in Ireland. I will, of course, admit straight away that most gluten-free products are certainly a lot more expensive than the gluten-containing foods. One interesting observation is airports the world over are complete celiac disasters. There's very little gluten-free food available at any airport in the world, and in transport generally it can be a problem, but all the restaurants, it's not a problem. You say it to the chef, or you say it to I've got gluten-free, and they'll oftentimes, and particularly all the restaurants around here, they'll come out, they have specific gluten-free menus. And from my point of view, I can see no difference between the gluten-free diet and the regular food, if you're not.
Yeah, so when you're going to the airport, Eamon, you have to pack your sandwiches.
I would pack your gluten-free sandwiches.
Okay, on that note, we'll take a break. We've loads more questions for Eamon, but if you'd like to throw yours into the pot, we'll do our very best to get through as many as we can. You can forward it through to Brenda if you prefer to do it that way. 066 712 3666. Just coming up to 2:15.
Medical Matters on Talk About, brought to you in association with the Bon Secours Hospital Tralee, celebrating 200 years of the Bon Secours mission.
Now, next up, Eamon, a listener wants to know, can you please ask the doctor, how do you avoid getting polyps in the colon?
The quick answer is you can't. Now, that's a very simplistic answer. One of the issues is that there are environmental factors here, but I'm talking about food environment more than anything else. It is generally accepted that Western diets are not great for our gut, and this manifests itself in a whole variety of ways. High fibre, but I'm talking about properly high fibre, way beyond what most Europeans will tolerate. Low energy density diets are generally associated with much less in the way of bowel problems generally, and polyps in particular. Now, there is a subgroup there that you have to be aware of. There are people who have this congenital polyposis coli, is what's called. It's a condition where they, because of inheritance, are more prone to developing polyps in the first place. But for most people, they typically it's down to again, our Western diet, high energy foods, lots of sugars, lots of salts and all that kind of stuff. And that seems to cause inflammation or irritation in the bowel at a low level, which over time leads to the development of polyps. When the difficulty with the polyps is that some, absolutely not all, but some of the polyps may eventually turn into precancerous or indeed cancerous lesions. And that's the reason why I've got the bowel screen program, which I'd encourage those people who are invited to take part in, because you get lots of warning before you develop a bowel cancer. But for a lot of people, if you get a colonoscopy done, there'll be incidental findings. In other words, you'll see that the person has polyps. The vast majority are going to be completely benign, but unless there is a really drastic change, and it nearly has to be outside of it, the whole population level is the only way you're actually going to reduce the level of polyps in the colon.
A caller is taking 7.7 milligrams of Zopiclone.
Yeah.
And is wondering about the side effects.
Yeah, I would refer people back to the talk we had, you and I, a couple of weeks ago about sleeping and the use of sleeping tablets and that kind of stuff.
Is that what that is?
That's what it is. So Zopiclone, it's 7.5. It's one of the so-called Z drugs. So I think most people would be aware of the issues there are with the so-called benzodiazepines, the classic benzodiazepine being Valium, but also things like Xanax and that kind of stuff. And the Z drugs then, which are Zopiclone and Zimovane, and there's a third one which escapes me at the moment. These were introduced that were supposed to be safer than the benzodiazepines. They're not. They have exactly the same problems, same issues. To repeat, I think what I would have said on that occasion, over very short periods of time, I'm talking about 3, 4, 5 days at most, and where there's a particular point anxiety or stressor that somebody is not able to cope with whatever it is that's going on, their sleep is being affected, it might be appropriate in a very, very short term to use one of these drugs, but not longer than that, because the effect is lost very quickly. They have significant dependence effect, and particularly in the elderly, there is a hugely increased risk of falls in people who are taking these tablets.
Yeah.
They're not good.
A caller has transverse myelitis.
Yeah.
She's had it for 16 years. Her question is, will the nerve endings heal or will she have it for life? She doesn't want to take antidepressants because they make her dopey.
Yeah. And I suspect the issue there is that the antidepressant medication, now there's two ways of looking at this. I've said many, many times, people who have long-term medical conditions are of itself much more prone to developing depression. Just they get depressed from being unwell for so long. I suspect, however, that there may also be a slightly different angle to this, in the sense that there are a group of drugs called the gabapentoids, so pregabalin and gabapentin, which are being used as a treatment to control the symptoms of nerve pain. They have a variety of uses. They may be used as a mood stabilizer. They were originally developed as a form of treatment for epilepsy. They're now mostly being used for pain management. The quick answer is, but looping back to where our listeners started from, the answer is probably not. Now, I've got to be very careful and I want to be realistic about this one. The difficulty is transverse myelitis, which is a condition where the person loses, if you like, the insulation from the nerves that come out of the spine, that leads to all sorts of neurological problems, weakness in the lower limbs, problems with the bladder and the bowels. The difficulty is we really don't know what causes it, and therefore, unfortunately, we don't have a specific treatment for it. And a lot of the time, it's how you manage the darn thing. I'd love to be able to, say to you, oh, look, this will probably settle down in time, but that would be not telling the truth.
A 57-year-old female has lipedema with severe knee pain. Would the doctor recommend a knee replacement?
Yeah. The lipedema part of it, first, is means that the limbs are very heavy, probably as a result of this condition, which again is a poorly understood condition. Knee replacement, knee surgery, is undertaken, if you like, as a last resort. If there's been complete destruction of the surfaces of the bones, and if you've got bone on bone at that stage, there really is no alternative except to go for knee surgery. The orthopaedic surgeons themselves will prefer not to use, would not resort to surgery if they can. Knee surgery is successful, but there is a but in there. People need to be appropriately rehabilitated, and it takes a while. If there's nothing else available, if there's nothing else that can be done, yes, it's going to be knee surgery, unfortunately. But it's the last rather than the first resort.
Caller in her mid-80s has very itchy and hot legs, mainly her shins, and yeah. She has a spot on each leg. She's using Benevate cream, but it's not working, yeah. And her back is also itchy.
Yeah. Okay, so Benevate is a very potent steroid ointment or cream. It's interesting because using the steroid ointment in itself, okay, there's a couple of double-edged swords there. Firstly, it may be that there's no inflammatory process going on, which is the reason why the ointment is not working. The difficulty is that the very fact that you're using the ointment or creams of itself may actually make the skin itchy, so you've got a big problem there. I think it's like everything else. You need to work out what's the underlying cause of this problem. Is it something to do with circulation? Is it something to do with the nerve endings? There is a condition called peripheral neuropathy where you can get uncomfortable, itchy sensations. Basically, somebody needs to go back and take a proper history for you. How long is this going on for? When did it start? What have you been finding? Are there any things that you're aware of that makes it either better or worse? Find out what's the underlying cause of the problem and then tackle that and treat appropriately. My own sense would be that you can never go wrong with using an emollient, just ordinary moisturisers. You could literally swim in them and they won't do any harm. One of the problems with the itching is the very fact of the itching. Sorry, you've got this itch, scratch, itch cycle. The skin is itchy, you scratch. But because you're scratching, you damage the skin, which makes your skin even more itchy. So if you're even just a massage on large, copious quantities of emollients every time you feel itchy, that might help alleviate some of your symptoms.
Now, a listener says, hay fever. My hay fever is terrible at the moment. Yeah. What could help?
Yeah, there are a couple of things. First and foremost, right now, this minute, pollen counts, I suspect, are relatively low, but of course, a week ago, they were mad. One of the suggestions is that for people who are prone to hay fever, really you need to anticipate the issue. In other words, that before the hay fever season starts, if you have been prescribed an antihistamine, start using the antihistamine. Now, there are a handful of them there. There's not a large number of antihistamines, but there are a number of them there. And the trick, apparently, is to start taking them before the hay fever season, if you like to try building
resistance.
Exactly. During the hay fever season itself, if you have to go, try to avoid going out for the for the shortest possible periods of time. Keep the windows and doors closed, which is miserable if it's a hot day. Avoid anything that kicks up dust around the house. So don't vacuum. Use damp cloths or whatever just to try and keep the dust down. There are other treatments available. There are more specific treatments. There are steroid nose sprays that can be used. There is a medication called Montelukast, which is effective but has potential side effects. And for some individuals, there are desensitization regimes. Now, you need to be seen by specialists about this. And what they can do is they can give you very tiny, tiny extracts of things that you might be particularly allergic to and gradually reduce your sensitivity to these things. But that's more a long-term project than something you can do in the next couple of weeks.
Now, we've a lady worried about her husband and worried about bringing down his cholesterol. She says he's 55, he doesn't have a sweet tooth, he eats a good amount of fresh fruit and veg and has a very healthy diet overall.
Yeah.
But his cholesterol is 6.5.
Yeah.
No tablet is being advised at the moment if he can bring it down himself.
Yeah. Okay, so the obvious things are look at the animal fat sources in the diet and reducing the amount of animal fats that you're taking. Whole grains can be useful, because actually back to the whole roughage in the diet argument, the thinking being that whole grains can also, as the jargon is, sequester cholesterol in your gut and carry it out of your body. And those are the kind of lifestyle measures you can undertake. Part of the problem here is the lot of our cholesterol levels are genetically determined. I hear what people are saying, and I've been there's this balance that you need to strike, in the sense that while the evidence for secondary prevention is really, really good, in other words, if you've had the event, or if you've got a family history of premature heart disease, or if you've got so-called familial hypercholesterolemia, then there is benefit in taking a statin. If you have none of those, and if you primarily have a high lipid level, you need to look at all the other risk factors. Part of the difficulty is that as this man gets older, literally just by being a man and being in his 60s in itself will probably tip him over into the category where he may eventually have to end up going on a statin.
83-year-old female caller had a prolapse over 2.5 years ago. She now has severe pain in her back and will be going into the general... excuse me, I presume she means UHK, yeah, to have a colonoscopy. What else can she do? And she's also asking, should she have the colonoscopy?
Well, quick answer is yes.
It's been recommended.
Yeah. I mean, the biggest problem with the colonoscopy is the fact that you have to take the appropriate bowel preparation beforehand. It just means literally you've got to clear the bowels out. So it means I call it a three-day procedure, the day before to clear the bowels out, the day of the procedure itself, and the day after is then to recover from it. Colonoscopy is not an issue. Well, it shouldn't be an issue, but it's important. If you go and have the colonoscopy, do the bowel prep, because otherwise it's a waste of your time, if not anybody else's. It's interesting that she mentioned about the prolapse. We're not sure whether or not she had the prolapse corrected, whether or not she had surgery for that, or some other thing done to try and help relieve the prolapse. It sounds like there's a number of moving parts there. A colonoscopy is a diagnostic procedure. If there's something wrong with the bowel, then the colonoscopy is probably the gold standard in terms of what's going on, and then if necessary, giving you the proper treatment afterwards.
Now, this is a very interesting one. We have a caller who's on Prolia,
yeah,
for the last few years. That's to strengthen the bones. But she has a tooth that needs to be extracted.
Yeah.
How soon can she have it done, and can she have it done while she's on Prolia?
Quick. Okay, so there's a couple of things there. So the generic name for Prolia is denosumab. Denosumab is one of the treatments. The difficulty is that, and I know that our dental colleagues have become increasingly twitchy about doing dental procedures like dental extractions in people who are on denosumab, because it does seem that in some individuals there can be a problem with the teeth when they're taking denosumab. I think what happens, but you'll need to talk to your dentist colleagues about this, I think what they do is they organise for specific x-rays of the jaw to make sure that there's no changes in the jaw before they try to go ahead and do the procedure. The difficulty is as people are getting denosumab or Prolia, it's a once in 6 months injection, so the injection is in your system for a long, long time. Best thing to do is talk to a dentist and they'll advise you accordingly.
Okay, and let me think. I know we're out of time.
We're grand.
But I'll just give you one or two more. A 78-year-old caller has swollen legs and wondering what she can do.
Yeah, again, it's where is this coming from? There are a number of reasons why people can get swollen legs. Now, if this was a week ago, I would have straight away been saying the heat. Exactly. But it may be a circulation problem, maybe due to the heart, it may be due to the kidneys. Again, you're going to have a conversation with your GP about that. You may well need to get appropriate blood and urine tests to try and work out where the source of the problem is and then treat it. I mean, the simplistic answer is, oh, here, take a diuretic. Proper diuretics is that they dehydrate the person. They don't necessarily reduce the swelling, but they will make the person dehydrated.
We'll finish on this one, Eamon. It's a man in his mid-50s. His problem is the right-hand side of his nose is tender to touch on the outside, but yeah, the inside is also quite painful.
Yeah.
And this is going on for about 3 weeks.
Somebody needs to look upside there. I'd be concerned about that. That would be so
much. Did we have that question or something similar to it last week?
Not that I can recollect, okay. But the thing about it is it would certainly be, to me, a source of concern about this persistent discomfort. That's always something you'd be worried about as well, somebody's persistent discomfort. Again, somebody needs to look up inside the nose in case there's something going on up there.
So he might need a referral to an ENT.
Oh, ENT, exactly. Or they start off by going to your own GP and let them do the examination, see what the story is. Now, it might be that there's some bit of an infected spot or something inside the nose, but it could also be that there's something, that there's something else going on. And that's the reason why I'm suggesting you may need to see an ear, nose and throat specialist.
Okay. And finally, a listener, just, you remember the lady with the itchy legs?
Yeah.
Somebody else says, Antacin cream.
Yeah, it can be useful for relieving itch. I think again though the issue is why is the itch there in the first place?
Yeah.
I think the emollients is something you can do anytime and it won't do any harm, but it won't diagnose your problem either.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, Eamon, listen, we've gone over time, but as always, you're so generous with your time and thank you.
Not a bother.
And thank you to the listeners as well for sending in such interesting questions to us. We're going to take a break, folks. Lots more to come after these.
Talk About on Radio Kerry, sponsored by Kitty O'Shea's Seafood.